Ross and Lynette will be in discussion for about 45 minutes till 3:45, and then we'll go straight into the White Cube Black Room panel. So I'm sure that most of you would have seen Lynette's exhibition, which is currently showing in the Sam Steg Museum, Duality of Light. Lynette, you know, over a relatively short amount of time, has developed a very comprehensive body of moving image work, you know, which is very powerful and very resonant, and it's fantastic to see these works together at Sam Steg Museum for the Film Festival. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Ross Gibson again, who is going to talk with Lynette, and Ross has followed Lynette's practice for many years, so I'm sure we're going to have a very lively and informative conversation. So, over to you, Ross.
Thanks, Julianne. So, Lynette and I will chat. You'll listen in. But don't be shy. If there's some issue that you want to get involved in, let us know and chip in. We've got the mic, we'll keep it running. But if you want to sort of intervene at any stage, just catch our eye or say hoi, and we'll get in. We'll get into a kind of trialogue rather than a dialogue for a little bit. Lynette and I caught up very briefly yesterday and then decided to stop talking because we didn't want to be in a situation today where we're saying, that thing you said yesterday, yeah. Could you recount?
Yeah.
You know, we wanted it actually to be a lot more dynamic and responsive than that. And we also realised we probably haven't sat and had a chat in, I reckon, 2 to 3 years. Mm. So this should be, it'll be good to catch up. To get started, Lynette, I'm presuming that most people here have seen the show in the gallery here, and you don't need to know the context really behind that, but we'll probably touch on that quite a bit, where work comes from and so on. But can I just ask you about Duality of Light, the particular new piece called Duality of Light, and can I ask you, rather than the standard question about intentions and so on, can I ask you what it's teaching you, what you're learning from it already?
Yeah. That's a good question, Ross. It's an unpredictable work, and it's a work where, well, you will all know, what you see is only for you. And so I never see what anyone else sees in that work. It's not recorded, it's not held anywhere. It's a very private, private piece of work. It's just a configuration of elements in order to provide the space for the work to exist. But I am learning, I learnt with this work to be more, in a funny way, more personal. So it's interesting that it's then that you experience the work personally, because in a way it's the most personal work I think I've ever made. So it's in some sense it's teaching me a particular freedom, and maybe it's a freedom that comes with my practice getting to a place where it feels possible to start working with elements that are not just to do with myself being obscured, but myself being present. And then in the work, each person becomes present to themselves. And what it's showing me things that I didn't anticipate. There's cultural differences in making a dark space. I know that now from showing my work mostly outside of Australia, not in Australia. And I know that people respond to darkness very, very differently in different countries.
For example?
Americans find it hard to be in that dark space. I'm just making a general statement about if I had to go on the experiences of people here. And Wendy Levy from BAVAC said to me, you know, that was an incredible challenge to ask me to go into a dark corridor on my own. It's something I instinctively would not do, I don't want to do, even in a gallery. And yet, for me, it's an invitation to be in darkness is exactly that. It's an invitation. I think I'm more comfortable in darkness, and I'm less afraid. So there are, and I see this with my work in different locations, but I didn't anticipate such a strong reaction to being alone in darkness as this work generates. Some people don't recognise themselves at all in the work, and I didn't expect that.
Meaning the body that they think they have gets presented to them and they say, who's that?
Yeah, some people say, who is that person? And I know, you know, you're not seeing yourself in a way that you normally see yourself, but I think it's an interesting question about how disembodied we are and how we perceive ourselves and how challenging it is to see yourself.
The fear idea, another version of that, if fear's not too strong, if it's just an inkling, that's a kind of, fear's in the world for good reason, you know, fear makes you alert and gets you very focused.
Yeah.
And so the right amount of fear before it becomes a scary thing, the right amount of fear is sort of like delicacy.
Yeah.
And so to play with that is, without being mean at all, you know, without being power hungry, it's a delicate thing to do.
Yeah, I know. I thought a lot about it because I don't want. I think that it's exactly right. It's a balance between taking yourself somewhere that feels a little precarious, but feeling that you know where the edges of that fear are. So I made that space exactly as wide as I could touch the edges of, so that you can walk down and feel where it ends. And I tried to make it so that you felt like you could get to know the space a little bit as you were in it. It's the same thing I learned with Hold, actually, that I have to show where the end of the space is.
Hold's the early work from 2001,
yes.
It started, which is the Bowles work. Yep.
That it's important in these sort of dark spaces to find where the edges are and to know where things end in order to then be able to let yourself become immersed to get a little lost in the work. You have to be able to manage the space so that you aren't keep asking questions about it, about what might happen to you in it. And you know, someone said to me on the opening, well, you know, that was a challenging space, but because I know your other work, I knew nothing bad would happen to me in there. So I think it's about a learning about managing those spaces. I'm just a really big fan of darkness. And that kind of quality that, you know, darkness is hard to get now. It's hard to find.
Is someone like James Turrell instructive to you in that way? You know, his whole thing about there's too much light pollution on most of the planet now.
And yeah. Well, yeah, and, I love his work and I love what he's doing with light. And I go for those experiences, like desert experiences, where you feel like you're in, as much as is possible, getting the rhythm of the earth, feeling the rhythm of where we are, because you allow yourself to experience darkness and not just artificial light. But I'm making an artificial space.
And you're experiencing time.
Yeah.
One of the things we mentioned yesterday... I was saying I really like the instructions outside, the duality piece. It doesn't say stop, go. It says wait.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of waiting in your work. You know, in so many of your pieces, and especially downstairs there, they're all waiting pieces of some kind.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I suppose darkness is understood by its comparison with light, and time is understood by its comparison with, I don't know, not waiting.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can come to have a feeling, like, it's easy to have a feeling that everything you want to see or know is very easy to attain. And I am interested in the idea that not everything is present to us all the time, but that things reveal themselves or show themselves, and sometimes they do that because you offer them time. And... It was interesting to me, yesterday Raphael talked about, you know, artworks becoming bored in a gallery. And there is this, actually not new, but very old idea about darshan from Hinduism, which is the reciprocal gaze of the sculpture, the reciprocal gaze of the deity. And it's always been. It's not a new thing. It's the possibility that the thing you're looking at wants to look at you. And that if you give it that space and time, you might see something that you didn't know.
Mm-hmm. And if the thing you're looking at is darkness, it's there for you in a way. It's there in front of you and all around you. And it's one of those delicate sort of balancing acts, you know. It's is the darkness there for you to fill, or does the darkness really give you something?
Yeah. I think darkness gives us a little bit of ourselves back to ourselves. That is our imaginative self. Mm-hmm. Because I think stimulation of a lot of, stimulations coming from outside of us is hard to filter out. And I love a space that leads to contemplation, because then I might have a thought that I didn't have before. But I have done another work which isn't here, called Still Waiting. That's its name. So I suppose I could have put Be Still. But and that work is precisely about this space. Also, that not everything is, especially here, coming from Australia, I think there's a kind of understanding that not everything is ours to experience. And this idea, not of private, but of separate space or particular space, in a way that there's the idea of the public, but then there's the idea of space that might be very particular to a group of people, and not necessarily open to me. And so in Still Waiting, which is shot in the Flinders Ranges here in South Australia, you come to a space where there's a veil in front of you, and the veil is literally like a hide, and it's very similar to what I had to do to film, because I filmed big flocks of corellas that are, you know, out in corn, and there's thousands and thousands of them, but they're very sophisticated birds. They have they have scouts that fly ahead of the flock. So each flock will have a scout, and the scout will come in and overlook the place where the flocks are meant to meet at first light and last light. And if the scouts see anything that they think is unusual or shouldn't be there, then they give a warning call to the flocks, and the flocks will go somewhere else. So in order to film them, and maybe we'll just put them up without the sound so you can see a little bit of them. In order to film them, I had to be in a hide, and I had to be hidden in the dry creek bed, under kind of canvas, under trees in the darkness, so that the birds couldn't see me at all, in order that I could then film them. I might need to bring the lights down to see that, because it's shot in pre-dawn, so it's very, very low light. Yes, sorry, I am allowed to present my own work, it seems, so. Yeah, and this is a shot. So before, when you come into the space, when you're behind the hide, you see this shot of the birds in silhouette. But the moment you enter, you break that intimacy. So the moment the first person enters this space, that intimacy goes and is never presented to you again in this work. So again, I was thinking about this thing about a kind of privileged space or a particular space that's just not accessible to us all of the time. So then it will then cut, actually, not to this shot, but to a shot of all of the birds leaving the trees. And then you have to wait in the space if you want. If you want to wait in the space, the birds return. But someone walking into that space after you will see a tree with no birds in it. So it's about, again, that idea that if you stay still, something might show itself to you.
And it's an idea that space is charged, that it's psychically active somehow, which is connected, I guess, to the Hindu idea you were talking about, that the statue can look back as well, that there's something coursing around.
Yeah.
And then that you step into that liveness all the time.
Yeah, and it feels a little bit, in this case, so we might wait. So you can see this is now the empty tree that's downstairs in beautiful sunset. But if we watch a little longer, you'll see some of those flocks returning. And it is a little bit like choice about how you move in someone else's territory. And it's occurred to me, as I've moved around the world a lot, that I always have to take time, because sometimes I really stumble culturally. I'll do something that seems very normal to me, and it's actually offensive or just incongruous. And of course, you know, here we live with the circumstances of exactly that kind of attitude, of a misreading and a not seeing.
I was that was a segue, actually, because I was thinking people who are just listening in might see that your work is intensely private and about self-reflection. But one of the reasons I asked the very first question about how's it surprised you and what's it teaching you, I watched the development and the installation of the Hold piece, the Hold Vessel piece, and what surprised me, I don't know if it surprised you, was how social that work is. That there's this sense of your own personal contact with these kind of cosmic splendors that you're holding in the bowl, but how much of the work is about handing it over to someone else, what offering a bowl means, in cultural situations. And so that sense of the social that turns up in your work a lot, is it designed in? Does it just keep turning up?
Or? No, I think... have you seen enough of the birds now? You've seen a... does have a... It's a very loud sound. It's a round sound, actually. So that's why I switched it off, because they're extremely loud birds. You can see them. There's a lot of them. So that's great. We might bring the lights up a little bit. Thanks. I never think of my work as very personal. I think of it as intimate, intimate. But I am always thinking about how we operate communally, and that's why I look for gesture, because gesture seems to be a way that we can communicate with one another without needing much explanation. And with Hold, I was also looking for. Similarly to what you were talking about before, complexity. How can I put the viewer in the system? And then not just that individual viewer is in the system, but that the system contains us as a community, not just as individuals. And so this gesture, the offering gesture, is a very normal gesture, passing the bowl. But Hold surprised me, because I could imagine people holding the bowl, but I didn't realise how ceremonial this would then be, and the beautiful kind of gifting of the work to other people, which is great, because you're dealing with a delicate material in a literal way and a non-literal way.
Because the bowl is so delicate as
And the environment is delicate. And this idea, which has become more pertinent in 2007, Michael Connors, who's here, commissioned the next stage of Hold for the BFI, which was really great, because then I could go back to the work I'd always imagined. And when I first talked to you about it, I said, this will keep growing. In 2001... there's footage in Hold which is from kelp forests in southern waters off Tasmania, and 60% of those kelp forests, the giant kelp forests, are gone. In 2007, I could go back to that work and include imagery from the transit of Venus, which occurred in 2004. And that's of particular interest to me because it was the reason Cook's Endeavour voyage was sent. The first commission for that voyage was to observe the transit of Venus in Tahiti. The second commission was to go and search the Great South Land. And I loved it that Halley, you know, of Halley's Comet, had this idea that ships should be sent to the four corners of the Earth in order to observe the transit of Venus, to try and work out how big the solar system is, each planet in relation to the other. And that was a moment when the British and the French attempted to cooperate. Though they hated each other and they'd been at war, but it was actually, I think, the French who said, well, you know, we don't really want these British ships landing. However, this is an idea. This is an endeavour that's to the benefit of the whole of humanity. Yeah. So here we are.
It's bigger than nations.
You know, 1761, 1769, two transits of Venus in that amount of time, and there was that attempt to cooperate scientifically.
And there's all of these treks happening, all of these long journeys, all of these pilgrimages and acts of witnessing.
Yes.
Neat segue to the mountain piece downstairs.
Yes,
which is about pilgrimage, about the difficulty of getting somewhere, and then I would imagine the intensity of the experience once you're there.
Yeah.
And the witnessing of it.
Yeah. So I did a residency in Iran in 2004. I went looking for a residency. There weren't that many in 2004 in Iran. I found one. And my host, Ahmad Nadalian, is an environmental artist, and that's his wife, Tayebe. So we would go with Ahmad to do his work, and I got to take my tools with me, and I would photograph. But, yeah, it was the beautiful and tricky thing about that residency was our relationship to place and land was so completely different. So Ahmad's practice is to carve into rocks. So he'll just go out wherever he is and start carving into rocks. And he wanted me to film him doing this. And so I had to make a lot of speeches standing out in the land, you know, about how that wasn't something I wanted to do and that's not a practice that I could take up and that I was here to do my own work. And so it was a difficult negotiation and a kind of really beneficial one, a really beneficial one in the end, because it was a tussle. Mm. And we did tussle. And now, you know, that work is the result of my just wanting to watch that mountain, but from that position which wasn't carving into it, but seeing this kind of shifting veil that goes across it because of time.
And I imagine while you're there with it over several days...
Weeks,
okay. Mm. Whatever preconception you've brought to the scene has gone a couple of days in, and there's other ways of knowing the place that are starting to emerge in your own mind, which means that how you're catching it, how you're recording it, is changing.
Yeah.
Is that right? So that it keeps sliding as you're making it.
Yeah, because I took a moving image camera with me as well, so I have everything from those 4 weeks on video. But I haven't used it and I won't. Because when I was there, I realized that it was much more interesting to me to see the way these kind of temporal things were being shaped by that moment, that atmosphere, the wind, you know, what was happening just in that instant. And that it was much easier to see that shaping of something by using the still and not by using them moving. And when I look at that moving image, I can't see exactly the change that's occurring.
So that means that the still image, somehow, the ones you select are the ones that are a still image of change.
Yeah.
How do you know that? How do you see it? How do you recognise it in when you go through the contact sheets?
I guess because I just I photographed it in a time lapse, so I could see, you know, cloud changes. I could see changes in fabric. I could see what I mean is that the still image in Damavand worked for me because it just holds for a minute. Long enough, like a fraction of time, long enough for you able to see the shape that's formed, rather than that being so kind of fluid that you lose the subtlety of it.
And then you decide it's three screens.
Yeah, I know.
How come?
You know, because I wanted to include Taiyabe in the work. Taiyabe and the mountain is a kind of important elements, and there seem to be three elements, the poppies. And so I decided that I would work with the three screens because as I was thinking about it, there were three kind of elements, each of them which were being changed by time. Each of them kind of showing this temporal change. And so because of that, I thought this is going to work better if I can show them occasionally together.
Because for me, the piece is very musical. There's a very slow music to it that, and who knows where music registers in your person, but it seems to be a work about looking, but it actually, where it's kicking in is somewhere else than in the optics. Me and it's something to do with the rhythm that's going on there, and therefore it's something to do with editing. And I know that you worked with Rhys Graham, and so you and he must have found something together in it as well.
He found that dissolve, which is not quite smooth, you know. So you sort of see the trace of the image before, which is very beautiful. And I wanted moments when the screen was obscured completely by cloud, for example. So to work with him on that, you know, it was really that thing between Rhys's tradition working in film and mine more in galleries, and to say that's actually a beautiful thing to have, to have almost no image. But yeah, maybe it is musical. I never think of myself as very musical, but and that has no sound.
Yeah.
But it has smell more for me because it's very aromatic, that area. And the whole ground is covered in oregano and beautiful herbs. So I smell that work more than anything. Yeah.
A chance for anyone to kick in with something? Anyone want to? Yeah?
Talking about not thinking of yourself as musical, but the way you put that together is highly rhythmic.
Well, I mean, there's a rhythm to visuals as well, I think. I mean, the pace of things, and
there's blinking.
Yeah, and well, it's instinctive, I think, and I try a lot to slow things down. One challenge I have with duality of light is that it's possible to experience that really quickly, and I can't control that. In many other circumstances, I can make things slow. I can't make duality of light any slower, but I always tend towards something that is much more slowly turning.
For me, duality of light is quite a departure from your previous work, especially in that it's more abstract.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I said that to Ross. Ross didn't think that it was so different, so it'd be good to hear what you think, Ross.
One of the things for me, it's there's the glow, the sunset tree work, you know. For me, that's such a kind of simple as to almost not be there piece, but very, very difficult, very deep as well, just because of that. I mean, any time we've seen that light that lives in the tree, you know, that John Shaw Nielsen wrote a poem about it.
One of my favourite poems.
When you see it, it's just, I don't get it. I've seen this three or four times in my life, kind of thing. And you just go, well, so, but then to find a way to use a camera to get it and give it over. So that meditation on glow, and once again, that's therefore that sort of delicate edge between the perceptible and the imperceptible, the clouds and the mountain piece. And for me, one of the beautiful aspects of duality of light is when you turn around to find your way out, and that sliver of light is mm-hmm. so exactly right, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. just enough to help you out, but mm-hmm. ghostly, almost not there, milky. So for me, there's, you know, real continuities constantly at a formal level, I guess, whereas that's what you're talking about, Julianne, is kind of content almost, isn't it, thematics and so on. Which I think the real interest in abstraction, self-abstracted, that's a slightly new thing.
Yes.
But formally, I see real continuities.
We had Pete Rondo worked on the video system and the image manipulation, and we had different ways of exploding the physical. The image of you. And for a long time we worked with these just kind of particles which were very small, and they dispersed very quickly, and in a way they were more organic, and most people preferred them. Pete preferred them. Everyone I was working with preferred them. I could see why they were beautiful, but they didn't persist. And so I went with the lines, because the lines keep going. And it was an important thing for me with that experience of the work, even though in a sense they make it more dramatic than my work normally is. But if you stay with them, the fact is they're still you. And the idea, because it was part of the work for me, that you're not recognisable, but actually it's still you. In that space, those lines are you. And whilst you are there, they'll stay. And when you leave, they fade. And so it was the persistence of you in that form that made me go with that choice that was kind of a little bit different to the way my imagery normally looks, because it's normally much more organic than that, I think.
And there's a chance that there's some critter or some stone or some orange in the world that sees you like that, you know, that.
Yeah. Well, I see myself like that. So that's why I think it's my choice. Right. Like, it's an experience. And this is the only really time in my work where I've referred to myself. That's what I mean, I guess, about being more personal. And normally I don't talk about myself. And often my work is not about myself. It's about us. But in that work, I felt like that's more about me
and
my way of seeing.
If the abstractions had been those droplets, that would have tied it very, very directly and interpretively to the soundtrack. Whereas at the moment, the soundtrack, it definitely has connotations of submersion and immersion.
Yes.
But I think it's good that, it would have just been too locked in. It would have been the droplet.
Yeah, and, you know, so I had Chris Watson out here, who, you know, probably a lot of you will know, because he's the most incredible sound recordist. And he came...
He used to be with Cabaret Voltaire.
Yes, and he's recorded with David Attenborough for 20 years. And so he came with these beautiful sounds. And those cave sounds are coming from the Waitomo cave system. So it's really this ancient limestone caves. But at some point, Chris would bring in different sounds. And at one point, he did bring in the sounds of just one droplet. And then we decided that was too literal. And then at that end point, he, in fact, had a kind of dispersal of the same sounds that you hear in the entrance. And I asked him for something that was more opening up and expansive rather than something that was closing down. So he went with that sound, which is exactly submersive, because it's the sound of waves but recorded from underneath the wave, in the water under the wave. So Yeah.
And you needed, you asked him for something a bit more expansive. Why? Because I'm thinking it's something to do with the space not closing down too much.
Yeah, and for that end moment, I mean, for that end moment to feel like something was expanding, not something being finished or completed. Yeah, and it's a trick with this work because some people staying in there a really long time. And Pete said to me, should we put something in the system where we just stop it? At some point, so say someone's in there for half an hour, we tell the system reset. But I thought not. Well, I think we just have to let people be in there.
And that's another way that it's a sort of, that it is a social work because you're in there, you're therefore taking up someone else's time outside.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
that kind of negotiation that's very... very slyly implicit in the whole thing.
Yes, I know, if you're conscious of someone else. I don't know.
Other folks or something? Yeah, at the back.
I was going to bring up a point you raised a minute ago about abstraction, because you were saying that the abstraction, the interest from the abstraction is one of the elements of the work, and I think that's true in a way, but then I was also going to raise the idea that some of the previous works of Linux used kind of representational imagery in the service of abstraction. And I think that Hold is probably the clearest example where the images are really unidentifiable in the glass vessel. And it's also like the images themselves don't have like a shape. There's no frame in that piece. It's basically like a horizontal plane. You have to walk around until you kind of find the image. So there's like an abstraction of the image. I'm just sort of interested in like whether, well, I guess what your own like interest in abstraction is, or if that is like something you were trying to push with, because I guess it comes up again in Still Waiting. You have like the birds are representational figures here, but then they're shown like when they're shown especially in close up, they just become like these fancy sort of shapes. I guess the question is like, to what extent is that like, you know, because there is like a real connection to landscape and nature that comes across the work. But what extent does the abstraction in those images like interfere with that connection, or maybe like encourage that connection?
Yeah, I think it's intriguing. Abstraction is intriguing and it's enticing. I think it's a little bit like you were talking about, Ross, with pattern, and I do look for that. So I look for things that are holding my eyes longer than something else, so I tend to choose imagery that's a little bit obscuring what you're trying to see. But it's always in kind of the service of trying to help you stay with the work and to become immersed in the work. And with Hold, it was important to choose imagery that had no kind of... I had no horizon largely that you couldn't really detect in above or below. And it's not true for all of the imagery, but it is true for some of it. So that your way of viewing shouldn't be restricted either, like Inuit viewing. Like you should be able to see, read that piece of text, whether it's upside down or sideways. That's more how I'm thinking. Could, you know, can this be readable to me no matter my relationship to it? I love those silhouettes of those birds for that reason as well. And you can kind of change them and view them in many different ways and still experience the pleasure of them. But it's kind of, it is a little in the service of helping you be enticed by the work. Yeah. And then, you know, there's works that are not abstract at all. I don't think like Evolution of Fearlessness, which is also a work that's not here. It's very kind of almost formal portraiture of women. Sort of very modest but kind of straight, really.
It's a piece that requires a gesture, a hand gesture, between a chicken and egg, between you and the represented figure.
Yeah.
But you were saying and this is me leading you to the abstraction issue again. You were saying how how striking it is that the people, the visitors, encountering the represented figure, assume
their posture.
So there's an abstraction of sort of bodily presence.
Yes, that's this one here, Evolution of Fearlessness, the second one. Yeah. So this is the second in a trilogy which began with Invisible by Night, that's here, and I think ends with Duality. And I filmed 11 women. This also has sound, but we'll leave it off. And all of them live in Australia, but only two of them were born here. And so they're largely political refugees, but not all. They have come from Eritrea, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. One was in Dachau, one was in a gulag for 6 years. But I wasn't looking for women who'd endured terrible stories as my endpoint. I was looking for a particular quality of spirit, or if you like, presence. And so the way you experience this work is, first of all, as you saw, there's a text, and you come into the space and you read the text, which doesn't have anything to indicate to you which woman is which. So, in fact, they're very specific stories that each have come from the tellings of these women, but there's nothing to link them to their image. And then there's a pulse of light which you can see, and when you put your hand on it, one of the women steps forward, and she puts her hand on your hand. So you have this moment of video touch, which is the thing that I was after. That she's looking at you, but she's not speaking. And everything you can actually read from her is coming from her body and from her eyes and the way she's holding herself. And what's interesting to me in this work is how frequently people's bodies actually shift to mirror those women. And that's not something I anticipated.
Alexei, will you...
Yeah.
I'm interested in your practice about that sort of feminist duality as well, like sort of throughout the way that moving image is adapted and technology is adapted in my artists. I think this work is a very good example. I was going to mention this work, the work downstairs, when I came upstairs to you before, I had to hold my hand up to you and I saw feel that gesture.
Yeah.
So for those of you who couldn't hear, I mean, forgive me for summarising, but it's a comment about how a lot of experimental practice for a long time has been the province of women artists, particularly in the video and film kind of domain. And does Lynette want to talk in any way about that?
I realised a little while ago that I really only ever film women, and that wasn't conscious, but it's certainly apparent. I think, you know, I think you're right. I have had to find people to work with who understand what I'm wanting to get from these technologies, which is often very slow and responsive. I don't know if my work is read. You know, I'm sure it's probably read as being quite female, because I am interested in themes which are more emotional. But I think they're linking themes. I think they're universal, and there is a lineage to that, I guess. You know, taking these technologies and finding your way through them, even though it's a very particular path. And finding the way to talk about the very things you want to talk about, even though, you know, when I showed work to Victoria Lynn years ago, she looked at my work and she said it was really interesting work, but it wasn't the kind of work other people were doing. And I think she was making comment on the content of the work. And Victoria has since come to show my work a lot. But it's about kind of persisting in your trajectory, even though it might not fit the times. And I think that has something to do with the way I work, that I have just had to persist. And it has something to do with the persistence of being female, I think.
Lynette, we could keep on talking, but
we
cannot. can I ask you to thank Lynette very much? And I know that there were other people wanting to talk with Lynette, so maybe you can grab her one-to-one.